Well, it's the end of April. Spring certainly taking its time to arrive in Wisconsin this year, but kind of came over the weekend, at least through a good share of the state. Larry Mueller here. Still a start of the severe weather season. There are important things to know about those storms. And Steve Ackerman, who directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, with me right now. We will soon be joined by John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. In the meantime, you may have a weather question. Maybe it's about tornadoes. We can still certainly continue to talk about tornadoes with Steve and John. But you may have some other questions as well. So I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. Steve Ackerman, welcome.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Had a great weekend, too. Enjoying the very nice weather.
Oh,
in southern Wisconsin.
Really nice. And, yeah. You know, here we've got the opening of the fishing season coming up. And somebody was telling me, I was where it was in the northern, up near where our cabin is located, there was still 22 inches of ice on our lake.
So ice fishing, well, don't go out on it.
Even though there's a lot of ice out there, it's rotten, and you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
you don't want to be.
You don't want to be wandering around.
Yeah. But the waters are, yeah, they're really cold, which seems to be delaying, like crappies. I know some people have been really getting a lot of crappies now. I guess they're running, which seems a little later than normal.
Yep, it does. Yeah. Sarah in Sparta has a question for you, by the way. Mm. Sarah, hi.
Hi. It's good to hear about weather. I'm kind of a baby weather nerd. I'm a trained spotter, but my first year was last year, and we really didn't have much to spot around Wisconsin.
And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I was actually kind of glad. I mean, you want the excitement of seeing something, but you really don't want the excitement of seeing something.
Right, yeah. You want to see it go over a nice open field with nothing there.
yeah, exactly. No, actually, kind of what started me on it is I'm interested in the way the world works anyway, but when I was 7 years old, my family and I were kind of trapped in a little itty bitty farmhouse with an outside door to the basement in the 1977 derecho that went through northern Minnesota, through northern Wisconsin, and into the UP of Michigan, killed a few people and really did a lot of damage. And when I was doing my last weather spotting training, I noticed that straight line winds were kind of mentioned, but then we didn't get any specific training in how to identify them, except watch out for shelf clouds, watch out for the bow echoes coming through, things like that. And I remember talking to the trainer afterwards, and he said, yeah, they really would like to get more information out there, but they're kind of hard to spot on the ground. There's just a whole lot of wind. I was wondering if you could describe more about how frequent derechos are and the kind of damage they can do.
Mm. Yeah, they do a lot of bad damage. Frequency-wise, we just did a map of this, of derechos, and our area is one of the more prominent areas, but I think on average we get maybe one or two every couple of years. So they're not that frequent. There was the big one that hit Washington, D.C., and that whole area last year. Was that last year? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the weather forecasts out there didn't even heard of it.
Yeah.
The phrase derecho, the word derecho. So they didn't even know what it is. But people know about it now because there was one that hit D.C. went from Minnesota all the way across the Great Lakes area and right into New England. And you're right, they are hard to spot, except I would think they would start doing more training with smartphones because, as you said, what the trainer said was, you know, you can spot them on radars because they have a very distinct bow to them, as you mentioned, the bow echo. And so I would think that that's probably a good way to start identifying the potential of them coming is by having smartphones with radar imagery on them.
Yeah.
Yes. I remember doing a little research, and I think that the storm I was in, the 77 storm up north, was the one where Fujita was looking at the radar imagery that was captured and first noticed the bow echo. So I guess there's a little bit of meteorological history up there.
Yeah, there is. And it's interesting, as you point out, because, Fujita was using radars, and they were so new back in the 70s for doing this type of studies, where they had the resolution to actually study them. And now, you know, before I came over here, I got my iPhone out, and I checked the radar and said, I better grab an umbrella just in case.
There you go. I remember that storm as well because it just sort of leveled an area of the Shawamigan National Forest where we used to hunt or hike and so forth. So
yeah, they're really dangerous.
You're not with one.
Yeah, they're very, very strong winds, and they knock down trees. I mean, they just flatten the forest.
Yeah. Thanks, Sarah, for calling. Appreciate it. And Margaret in Waterloo. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, hi there. I'm calling about something that's much more benign, but last year I was looking out over an empty farm field.
Yep.
And I swear there was, it looked like a long, lean, whirlwind of some sort that
funnel.
Was picking up mm-hmm. the dust.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it, what the heck was that?
It's what we call a dust devil. Was it clear skies out too?
Yeah.
So these are just solar heating of a dry area, and then it starts a whirlwind, and then that whirlwind just intensifies and it picks up dust, and it kind of looks like a tornado that's not connected to a cloud, although it doesn't pick up a lot of dust because it's not that strong.
It seemed to dissipate.
Yeah, they dissipate pretty quick. They're not that strong. It's funny because I was watching a Facebook post of a former student of ours who now works in Oklahoma, and she was out tornado hunting, and what she got to was a bunch of dust devils. And actually, she's in there filming, you could tell, and then all of a sudden she's in it. And it just didn't sound like a lot of fun.
No.
I mean, she wasn't hurt, but you're going to get scratched up by debris that...
Yeah,
flies
for
around sure. Those things.
I can remember driving in Arizona. If you drive across Arizona,
Arizona has a lot of them.
A lot of them. You'd see them every few miles.
Yeah, yeah.
As a matter of
fact, and actually Mars has them as well. So NASA imagery from the vehicles that they send out there have also captured them.
Hmm. Thanks, Margaret. Appreciate the call. Yeah, Pammy in Elroy. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I was calling to ask a question. A long time ago, I was told that the lakes surrounding Madison protected the city from tornadoes. Is that true? Do the lakes really have that much of an effect on it?
No, they don't. I wish they did.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's just, it's kind of interesting. If you take out a map of Wisconsin, close your eyes and draw 20 straight lines of different length, and then look where they fall. We get about 20 tornadoes a year. And so the chances of them going over a lake are actually just not that great. And so it just so happens that they don't, hit lakes or any area very often. The good news is that, you know, with smartphones again and cameras, a lot of people now are capturing images of tornadoes, and there are some great images of tornadoes going over lakes. Which, you know, so again, if you don't believe us, there's YouTube stuff out there now that people can go and look at, and it's really kind of amazing because they just scoop up all this water. They're pretty neat.
Yeah, thanks a lot for going. I interviewed a fellow who wrote a book about fishing. It was a great book, by the way. It was a lot of fun. And he was out on one of the northern Wisconsin lakes when a tornado came across the lake. And he got off to the side, but he actually watched another boat tried to beat the tornado, just got to run away from it. And the tornado caught up with him, and they everybody on that boat perished.
Yeah. I mean, you don't try and outrun a tornado because they could be traveling 60 miles an hour. The best thing to do is to, get shelter. If you're on a lake, get off the lake.
Get out of its path. Yeah, the paths aren't really always necessarily a straight line either, is it?
No, right. Yeah, they can turn. They can move erratically.
But I'd be going at a right angle to one anyway.
But that's right. Yeah, right at a right angle. Right.
And they've also heard, just on this, well, actually, in the book that that we were just talking about, Lee Sandlin's book, Storm Kings, among the myths, one of the myths that they say about tornado is if you're out on the road, don't get under an overpass.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing you can
do. That's the worst thing you can do. And what really populated that was that someone did that. And they went up under an overpass, up to the corner, and a tornado went over, but it was a really weak tornado. And, of course, they videoed it, and then they posted it on YouTube. So people thought, oh, they survived. I could go do that, too. But that is not a good place to be.
No.
You get sucked right out.
You can get sucked right out. In fact, even worse. And if you're better off out in an open field or try and find a little ditch or something.
Yeah, laying down to protect yourself from flying debris. That's one thing you want to do.
That's what most often is going to kill
right.
you.
Right, yeah.
And as he pointed out in his book, a piece of cardboard can kill you.
Yeah, traveling to... I mean, there's some great images. I remember as a kid from a National Geographic issue. I don't even know what it was, but there was a piece of straw that was stuck into a telephone pole. Like somebody threw it as a dart.
Yeah, it was just like, amazing. Well, we've got our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, with us, and we're talking weather with them, of course. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234, and they will be with us right up until 12:30. But stick around here. News next. Last year, we had an incredibly warm March and a cool April, but this year, it feels like we're weeks behind the usual arrival of warm weather. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Lucky to have a monthly visit with our UW weather guys to help us understand what we're experiencing and to know what might be in store for us. John Martin, and professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, one of our guests. Hey, John.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for coming by.
You bet. Thank you.
And Steve Ackerman, who directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. Great to have you back.
It's great to be here.
We have callers online with questions. You may have one. If you do, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. If you've got a great weather photo, we always love to see. We have had some great weather photos posted up on my Facebook page. So I hope you'll do that as well if you've got a good one. We have Bob in Minocqua, who's been a weather guy for NOAA since 2005. Seems to him that for the past 3 to 4 years, we've had more high wind days than he can remember. Hmm. Or is that just not the case?
I don't know if it's really in the data. Now, one thing that now we're thinking about this, we're thinking about it a little bit over the break, is maybe the Weather Service itself has tightened up the criteria by which they issue warnings about high winds. That could be true. And if that were the case, then maybe you'd have a higher incidence of warnings for high winds. But I think in the real data, there's probably not any more significantly higher number of windy days than there have been in the past. And the reason I'm saying that is because almost all of the people who are making either statements about the current state of affairs or the future forecast for a warmer climate are saying that mid-latitude storms will actually be weaker at our latitude, and that means that the central minimum pressures will, on average, there'll be some strong ones still, but on average, they'll be weaker, and consequently, the pressure gradient, which drives the winds, won't be stronger.
Huh. Interesting. Well, so, that kind of goes along with a question that Carl in Beaver Dam had, I think, which is what effect will the loss of polar sea ice and the methane release from the Arctic region have on climate change?
Well, the methane could have a big impact, because that's a really strong greenhouse gas.
Yeah.
And so that would lead to a warming. And there's a lot of research now looking at as the ice sheet recedes, how that leads to a change in the circulation pattern. So instead of where you get the jet moving more northerly and southerly, in fact, there's some work that's pointing to the fact that that might be why we have such a cool spring.
Yeah.
There's the jet stream is too far north right now. No. It's the other way
around. Yeah, no,
it's
right.
Coming down. It's coming right at us.
You're right. We've been in the northwesterly flow for a long time. I'm skeptical of whether or not sea ice has that impact as the season unfolds. I just can't believe it. It seems a little bit disconnected physically, but I'm not in a position to say that I've read all that literature and really evaluated it. there's enough variability. I've done a little study on the side that seems to be a companion to this. There's enough variability in the way that the hemisphere cools down every winter that it might not be controlled by sea ice. That's what I'm thinking.
Oh, so what would cool? What would control it?
That's still an open question. It's an open question. I mean, there's something going on. The extent, the aerial extent of the cold air in the Northern Hemisphere winter has absolutely decreased in the last 60 years. There's no arguing that data. And how exactly or what's been driving that, I don't know.
Interesting.
Judy in Two Harbors, Minnesota has a question for you guys. Hi, Judy. Judy, are you there? Oh, wait a minute. First, Larry, push the on button.
Push the allow them to talk button.
Then turn the volume up. All right, Judy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, thanks.
Boy, how'd you get through the scrutinizer?
No, I'd like to go back to the tornadoes over water.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And when they suck up all that water and then they hit land, what happens to the water? Does it just flood the land?
I think it'll probably continue. Well, no, it will be dispersed. It'll be like the dirt. Eventually, it'll get tossed out. I don't think it'll flood it. You know, like you would see in a river flood or a lake flood. It's not that much because it would be picking up as droplets, sort of.
Oh, okay. Well, great. Thanks so much.
I've
heard stories. I don't know if they're apocryphal or not, of fish being deposited in the middle of a football
being picked
field
up
or something.
Too. Yeah.
So frogs.
They do drop things.
Yeah.
What is the difference, Herbeth in Eau Claire? What's the difference between real heavy winds and tornadoes?
So I'm assuming he's going to go back to the straight line winds.
Probably.
So the really strong tornadoes will be traveling faster in speed than the straight line winds, although the straight line winds can get above 100 miles per hour. I mean, so they'd be hurricane force type winds. And the tornado winds are rotating, whereas the straight line, as the word implies, are going in a straight line.
Yeah. So they might have a wider swath in many cases.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah, the tornado will generally be much smaller.
Pretty local.
Although you can get tornadoes a mile wide, too.
Yeah. You can get mile ones. So it would be big. But
the Edmonton tornado was a mile wide, 1988. A mile wide. I mean, I can't even imagine that.
Yeah. But straight line winds could be 60 miles.
Yeah, that's right. Wide, right. So.
Email from Marion Cederberg. All of the new radar technology has made storm predicting better than ever, but there have been so many tornado warnings based on the rotation seen on the radar rather than the actual spotting of a funnel cloud. Do you think crying wolf will cause people to ignore the warnings?
I'll give my own opinion on that. I can't believe when you see a green sky and you're screaming Dorothy outside that the false alarm is really going to upset you. I think that having that surveillance, knowing that there's going to be times where you're put under a warning or a watch and it's not going to come to fruition, it can still be scary weather. So I'd prefer to have a little bit of insurance on the warning side than not. That'd be me.
Yeah.
Samaji and Stevens Point says in the winter, the weatherman always says it's warmer near the lake. In the summer, he always says it's cooler near the lake. Mm-hmm. How can that be?
Yeah.
Well, in the summertime, the water is generally cooler than the land. And so as the air moves from the water onto the land, it'll cool down the land, and you'll get what we call lake breezes. And so you can sometimes feel them out here. All of a sudden, we'll get an easterly wind, and the temperature will drop by 10 degrees.
That's true.
And then in the wintertime, it's usually reversed. The land has gotten a lot colder. The ground itself is a lot colder. Than the water, unless, of course, you're up by Lake Superior or a lake that's frozen.
Yeah, then it's not much difference. But, water has what's called a high specific heat. It takes a long time to heat it up and a long time to cool it down relative to the land. You're measuring it against soil or trees or a canopy of leaves, and that makes the difference.
And then it tempers everything, so it doesn't make the big ranges change because it makes the winters warmer and the summers cooler.
And our lakes, Superior, man, that's a cold lake. Very cold lake.
Yeah. You fall into that lake, you don't have very long to get out before you die.
No. Yeah, it's like San Francisco Bay.
Al in Milwaukee. Hello, Al.
Hello. How are you guys doing today?
Just great. Thanks for calling.
Hey, with all this talk about global warming, I have a cabin up in Vilas County. There's still 30 inches of ice on the lake. Fishing season opens this Saturday. When's that ice going to melt?
Yeah, good.
By July.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a really prolonged late winter. There's no doubt about that. Boy, and I will say it's been local to this part of North America. That's one thing to keep in mind. It's warmer than average in, the Bering Sea area. It's warmer than average in northern Siberia. So there's places in the northern hemisphere that are not as cold as us, but... Yeah, I think I'll stick with Steve's forecast. It'll be gone. No, probably. All joking aside, that ice probably disappears after one or two really warm days that could come in the next 2 weeks.
And I would be very careful. I'm not sure, Al. Don't go wandering around out there.
No, I'm sure it's not strong.
No, yeah, there's probably weaknesses in the ice that'll crack.
You don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Al, thanks for calling. Bart in Shorewood. Hello. Bart, are you there? Shorewood tornado. Sorry about a Shorewood tornado. But I don't have a Bart. I think Bart was there. Hmm. You know about a Shorewood tornado?
I don't know if I've heard that story.
No.
I wonder when it was. That might help.
Yeah, well, we are not going to find out because he's lost. He's gone. Not forgotten, but gone. Where did we end up for snowfall this year? Were we pretty...
What was the number? We were over 70 inches. We did crack 70 inches, which was... put us in the top 10, I think, all time or something.
Yeah.
So it was pretty remarkable. And I think by about the middle of January, we were not even keeping pace for the season. Except for the December storm. Aside from that, we would have been way below pace. We had one big event in the first half of the winter, and then we had a series of modest events that got us over 70. A couple of them were relatively big, actually, I should say.
So do you think we're done with snow?
Accumulating snow, we're done,
So we're done?
For this season.
For the season?
We might
not
have
for the year.
Yeah, we might have accumulated
snow
again. That's
what I for the year. Do you think we got more snow coming?
No. I'll answer in a loyally fashion. Not to my knowledge.
All right. Well, Mary and Madison, what's on your mind? Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, I was wondering about the role of brine in cooling the earth. Is it because it sinks and makes water heavy? And then it goes down further into the seafloor and cools that?
That's an interesting question.
I think salty water, when you say brine, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you make the water saltier, it is heavier, and that helps to stir the ocean in what's known as convection. And there are certain parts of the globe where that convection is particularly powerful. One of them is at the mouth of the Labrador Sea. And if that doesn't happen, if for some reason or another that shuts down, there's a lot of reason to believe that the Gulf Stream ocean current, which supplies huge amounts of heat to high latitudes in the North Atlantic region and Western Europe, would also shut down. And there may be other examples of these so-called conveyor belts that are really driven by the production of that salty, cold, dense water that really kicks the convection in the North Atlantic up and maybe in the North Pacific as well.
What do you mean by convection?
Same thing as a thunderstorm. So when you see air rising in a thunderstorm and the clouds billowing up, that's a form of atmospheric convection. In the ocean, you can have convection as well, in which case you just have water columns that are heavier than the ones surrounding them, and they sink.
Hmm. Okay.
So in the atmosphere, it goes up, and in the oceans, it goes down.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mary, for calling. What... Steve in Central Wisconsin wonders, what does it mean when the sky turns... light green, or why does the sky turn light green before a storm?
You know, that's a really good optics question that I don't think anybody's been able to answer yet. What we do know is that usually when that happens, there's big hail in there and lots of water. And that lots and lots of water can be in the form of small drops. So it's just really loaded with water. I don't know anybody who's done any visibility simulations to try and get that green to form.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I know they talked about the green glow of icebergs just under the ocean in Antarctica, and they ended up concluding not long ago that it was refraction.
Yeah.
But I don't know enough about it. You're certainly more knowledgeable about that stuff, so maybe it's a combination of that.
Yeah. What we do know is that when you see it, it's coming.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's coming.
Is coming.
Take shelter.
Right. Don't be waiting outside.
Get out the way.
Darren and Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I had a question about how this previous winter has affected our groundwater recharge. You know, with the drought last year, well, the groundwater levels obviously were dropping a lot, especially on marshes and river systems that are primarily groundwater fed. My question is, with all of this snow melt this year, it seemed like it was going to be doing an excellent job at helping recuperate the groundwater, because, you know, I figure the ground didn't have as much chance to freeze, especially down in Madison. Is that accurate? Would you think that because of the weather we had this last winter, it helped recharge groundwater, at least near surface groundwater, more than a normal winter would?
Yeah, and I was checking just before I came over here about the soil moisture, and that down to 5 feet is all at or slightly above normal.
Yeah, great.
And that
great
was
news.
Not the case last year. I mean, we really had a soil deficit.
Right.
So, yeah, this winter, the amount of rain we had, the way that also I think it the snow went away also helped to recharge all the water.
Yeah. I think that's the key thing because, you know, we did have a wet beginning to this year. There's no doubt about that. So it's been a lot of precipitation. But, boy, the gradual nature of the snow melt allowed all of that precipitation and melt to really percolate and sink in. And if it had come all at once, we'd had a big rainstorm on top of, you know, 12 inches of snow. It would have just washed away into lakes because the ground would have still been frozen.
Yeah.
Okay. And are you aware of any kind of prediction tool that exists that you takes into account weather, soil moisture, and any kind of soil mapping to estimate or predict groundwater levels in the, you know, near future or, you know, year or 2 years out?
Boy, that's a good question.
I'm not aware. A place that I'd go right off, though, I'd go to the Illinois Water Survey and see if they can point.
Water.
Yeah, and I'd have to do a Google search with those words, Illinois Water Survey. They've had a long, long history of a combination of agronomy, meteorology, and then hydrology. They might really have some good tools there or some people you could contact to find that out. I bet you there is something.
That's where I go to find current conditions.
Yeah, it's a great place.
Illinois Water.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't know if they forecast. I mean, that's a pretty tough thing, particularly a couple of years out.
Yeah, I mean, basically anybody else I've asked has said, well, you're going to have to build your own model, taking all that stuff into account.
Yeah.
And because there are so many factors. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. We can get you on pretty quickly, as a matter of fact. We got open lines. Facebook question from Deb. Deborah says, I have an extremely bright 10-year-old who wants to be a meteorologist. Do you have any advice for a child who is very serious about learning this?
Get a weather station.
Yeah. That's a great suggestion there. That's a great suggestion.
A weather station.
Yeah. Or even if you... you know, if they're too expensive, I think there's companies like Oregon that sells pretty good weather stations.
Well, what is a weather station?
So they would make temperature measurements, moisture measurements, wind speed and directions.
Pressure. They usually have a barometer.
They usually come with a rain gauge, or you can just get a very simple rain gauge. And then, you know, keep track of it. Record it. A lot of these weather stations now will just transmit it right back into your home.
Yep.
That's
a great
idea. Spreadsheets.
I'd say that's a great idea.
Yeah.
That is a pretty good idea. I like that. What about, now that I've started to say something, I've completely forgot what. Just by record, what is it called when you record the weather events, the events that are taking place outside, the first robin of the year, or the first.
Oh, phenology. Phenology. That's another good thing to do. And don't get bored with your math. Stick with it. Find ways to make mathematics interesting because it'll pay off.
Yeah.
That's another thing to do.
Because when you're studying, I mean, in order to become a meteorologist, you kind of, what's your math level? What do you have to?
We have our undergrads take a 3-semester course sequence in calculus, and they have to take at least one math class that uses that as a prereq. So it's usually differential equations or some kind of vector calculus or something like that.
So you gotta learn to like math.
Yeah, and I think the way to do that is to make it interesting for yourself somehow. Play with it. And if you play with it, you find it interesting. If you don't, if you're just kind of going in there and someone's telling you how to do these operations, boy, it can be really boring. And it doesn't have any life.
Yeah, we have a 9-year-old at home, and wasn't as enamored with math, but we actually found a book, an outside book that we could that is kind of fun.
That's good. Has
a lot of fun, in you know, even some mysteries that involve our own math, using math to solve the mysteries.
Yeah,
and she's back up to A's in math again.
That's great.
So, I mean, if you particularly if you're collecting your own data, I think like weather data, it would be really interesting to start playing with that. When was the hottest? When was the coldest?
Yeah, yeah.
What's the relationship between temperature and relative humidity?
Right.
And analyze that stuff and make your own discoveries.
Yeah, how many days are above the average for the last week or something? You know, you can
When was the last day we had a 70-degree temperature? That was back in October or something like that.
All that stuff is so interesting. You know, this mathematics that surrounds streaks and various other things. It's very interesting, and it brings it to life and then keeps you ready for what you're going to learn.
Yeah. And it can all be recorded if you have can't afford an iPad or at least on your computer.
Run some
sheets and just have that for easy reference.
Yeah, right. Yep.
Every day. Jeff and Nina, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I have a couple of questions.
All right.
Going on vacation, my wife and I, we like to look at the weather in advance and like in telecast or AccuWeather. And she swears by AccuWeather being like 14-day out forecast and all this. How realistic can one... nowadays with technology forecast, a weather forecast for a region other than like Phoenix, you know, it's going to be 100 degrees for 5 days straight in July, you know, but in what site would you recommend, like a telecast?
I tend to go to a couple of places. The National Weather Service for the area that you want to look at. Weather Underground is also pretty good. AccuWeather, I generally don't go to, particularly their two-week forecast. I mean, that's going to be kind of almost random.
Especially in the warm season. It's not possible that it's accurate 14 days out in the warm season.
Yeah. And you know, and then again, as you were pointing out, it really depends on where you're going. So in Phoenix, you know it's going to be hot and dry, and there's going to be a chance of a thunderstorm if you're out there in the summertime.
All right.
Yeah, I agree with Steve. National Weather Service is a good place to go. They'll have a local forecast that you can read in words. Can't beat that.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Kat in Chippewa Falls, hello.
Good afternoon, guys. This past weekend, I watched the movie with The Impossible with Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor, and it's about a family vacationing in Thailand during the 2004 tsunami. A couple questions. First of all, what is a tsunami? And second, the movie made it appear that they literally had 3 to 5 seconds in order to get away from this fake tsunami. I'm wondering if that's accurate, if there's any warning that a tsunami is coming.
So tsunamis are generated pretty much by the earth moving. So it could be an earthquake, it could be a mudslide, it could be a volcano. And the water then, a whole bunch of mass of water starts to move. And that stuff can move really, really fast. 3 seconds, how much warning you have depends on where you are and how much you're looking. If you're at the beach before a tsunami hits, all the water is drawn out and goes out to make that wave that's on its way. So if you see all of a sudden the beach move out and you see all fish flopping around on the bottom and there's some great videos, it's not time to go walking out. It's time to get the heck out of there.
I think that's a matter of minutes in some cases.
You don't have a lot of time.
I actually saw a video of it, of that tsunami, where the person, the water went out, and then they panned up and said, "Oh, what's that coming?"
There's some white stuff.
It was this wave coming, and then people standing down in the shallow water, and the wave hits. Yeah. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. The good thing now too is there are a lot of tsunami warning systems around the country.
And with that, we got to close. We'll see you guys.
May.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, they'll be back. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.